right, welcome back. So our final speaker this afternoon is Dr. Miriam Solomon, who is a professor in the philosophy department at Temple University. She is the author of the book Social Empiricism, and she has a forthcoming book from Oxford University Press on the making of medical knowledge. She will be speaking to us today on the topic of hermeneutical injustice and agnotology in science, the case of the disappearance of Asperger's syndrome. Join me in welcoming Professor Solomon.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I've enjoyed the afternoon so far. I'm going to invite you to help me finish this paper. Because I'm not quite sure how to finish it yet. I've enjoyed reading Miranda's work, and when they asked me to participate in this conference, I thought, oh, I'll do the hard one. I'll do hermeneutical injustice. that's where I am, and I think it is hard. I think it's a very difficult concept. But I'm going to talk about a single case study, the case of the disappearance of Asperger's syndrome. Asperger's syndrome diagnosis began officially in around 1994 and disappeared officially about a year ago, at least in the US. And there's every indication that it will be removed from the WHO classification as well. So let me set it up, explain where I think there may be some hermeneutical injustice, show why I think it's hard to have a definitive answer, and then reflect back on what that says for the concept of hermeneutical injustice in general. Can you hear me at the back? Okay. So here's one way in which Miranda Fricker states the concept of hermeneutical injustice. It applies to the social processes that can get in the way of the core philosophical tasks to know yourself. It's a timely as well as an ancient topic because the identity movements of postmodern times have been life-transforming sources of meaning for many social groups. The core cases that Miranda discusses, the concepts of sexual harassment, the phenomenon of postpartum depression, and the understanding of sexual orientation, are cases in which self-understanding and societal understanding was impeded by societal prejudices and members of oppressed social groups held back from discovery and recognition of their own experiences. So here is the statement from her 2007 book. Hermeneutical justice is the injustice of having some significant area of one's social experience obscured from collective understanding owing to hermeneutic marginalization. In another place, she focuses more on the understanding of the people who are suffering from injustice themselves. She says some groups can suffer an unfair disadvantage in making sense of their own social experience. So, yes, this is my question. Is it a case of hermeneutical injustice? And what does the case say about the differences, the relationship between hermeneutical knowledge and scientific or medical knowledge? The literature that I'm engaging is not only Miranda's book. I'm going to connect it a little to the literature on agnotology, to Hilda Lindemann's book, Damaged Identities, Narrative Repair. Ian Hacking has a recent talk on the ratio of science to activism in the shaping of autism, in which he actually separates the two, what the scientists do and what the activists do, which is partly what I'm going to talk against. And there's a
a nice book by Andrew Solomon, no relative of mine, called Far From the Tree, which has the interesting concept of horizontal identity, which is the identity of people that you have with people who have similar life experiences, rather than vertical identity, which is your family, your heritage. So a little history of Asperger's. That's Hans Asperger. It comes out badly on this screen, but it's not a great photo anyway. He was an Austrian pediatrician who, in 1944, in the middle of the Second World War, described a case series of four boys with what we now recognize as Asperger characteristics: a lack of empathy, little ability to form friendships, one-sided conversations, intense absorption in a special interest, and clumsy movements. He described them as autistic and as, quote, little professors. At the same time as the Nazis' final solution, he argued for the importance of human diversity in saying, not everything that steps out of line, and thus, this is the translation, it's not very good English, and thus abnormal, must necessarily be inferior. He didn't call it Asperger's syndrome. It was Lorna Wing who rediscovered his paper and revived the category. Lorna Wing is a British child psychiatrist. And she distinguished it from Kanner's autism, which was the autism that was mainly understood by the mental health community. So even though Asperger called it autism, she thought it deserved another term. It was championed by influential psychiatrists as well as by people with the disorder. The first diagnostic criteria appeared in 1989, the WHO criteria in 1993, and in 1994, it was introduced in the DSM-IV. The reception of the new Asperger's diagnosis was enthusiastic, at least from people who identified with the diagnosis. And here are some typical statements. And I take these from various articles and blogs. I grew up without a label, and after having many thrown at me in my late teens, finding Asperger's was like finding a glove that fit. That's a woman called Catherine Anear. Then a man called Michael John Corley was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at the age of 36, just 1 week after his 4-year-old son received the same diagnosis. And he says, "Not only was my son being presented with an explanation, but I was finally presented with an explanation of what I'd endured my entire life. I don't have the words to describe the biblical weight being lifted off of me." That's a very, very strong statement. It seems no question that the Asperger's diagnosis offers hermeneutical gains for a group of people formerly marginalized by social disabilities. Indeed, just as the rise of gay liberation and women's liberation followed hermeneutical enlightenment for gays and women, advocacies such as Aspies for Freedom and concepts such as Aspie Pride have followed the authorization of the Asperger's diagnosis, now seen as both a diagnosis and as a positive identity. The so-called neurodiversity movement has people with Asperger's at its core, although it includes others such as ADHD and Tourette's. The movement argues for the desirability of traits such as intense focus, systematizing ability, preference for being alone, and so forth. Temple Grandin, who's probably the most famous person with Asperger's, thinks that Silicon Valley would be depopulated if Asperger's disappeared. The most well-known expert on Asperger's syndrome, Tony Atwood, says, quote, "From my clinical experience, I consider that children and adults with Asperger's syndrome have a different, not a defective way of thinking." The Aspie identity has been so successful that it has been increasingly applied to describe any socially incompetent or inconsiderate behavior. A 2012 piece by Benjamin Wallace in New York Magazine calls it the defining psychiatric malady of the generation. And it points out the association of Asperger's with stereotypes about male gender. Eva Gillis Buck and Sarah Richardson have a forthcoming piece arguing that autism and Asperger's have become a biomedical platform for sex difference research. And I recommend that paper. You can get it from Sarah Richardson. It's a very interesting paper. But what we're focusing on here is the question about hermeneutic injustice. And DSM-5, published a year ago, this May, removes the Asperger's diagnosis. It is removed. It's no longer a DSM category. In its place are ASD, Autism Spectrum Disorder, with degrees of severity, and a new category called SCD, Social or Pragmatic Communication Disorder. And what this takes the place of is what was in the DSM-4, which was classic autism, PDD, pervasive developmental disorder, PDDNOS, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which was a grab bag of things that didn't quite fit the diagnostic criteria, and Asperger's. Asperger's is supposed to be partly autism spectrum disorder, but also partly social or pragmatic communication disorder, because some people with a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome do not have repetitive behaviors and obsessions with strange interests. They just seem to have deficits in social communication. So one set of categories has been replaced by another. Well, I'm sure you can see that this could be perceived as a hermeneutical injustice to people with Asperger's, and indeed many of them have been very upset about it because their category disappears. Now, it's a little bit unlike the cases of hermeneutical injustice that Miranda talks about, because here we sort of go backwards. You know, instead of going from, well, we didn't understand postpartum depression to we do understand it, we go from we don't understand Asperger's to we do understand Asperger's to we don't again. So we go from ignorance to knowledge to ignorance. So it's a nice example for the agnotology literature for people who are interested in the manufacture of ignorance. Londa Schiebinger, for example, has a case in which knowledge of abortifacients from the Caribbean was lost after the 16th century. She talks about the structural, societal causes of that loss of knowledge. Well, of course, there's an official reason for the, quote, disappearance of Asperger's. And the official reason is that the category is not sufficiently distinguished from other autism spectrum disorders, either in symptoms or in hypothesized causes or mechanisms, for the diagnosis to be reliably distinguished from other diagnoses in the DSM-4, such as high-functioning autism and pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. Many people have said, how do you tell the difference between high-functioning autism and Asperger's disorder? And different psychiatrists say different things. There isn't a standard answer to that. And so the idea here is that it's going to be more standardized so that this different psychiatrists will give the same diagnosis to the same people instead of some of them giving one to one and another to another. It may look as though we've got an improvement in a concept here, which is going to lead to less ambiguity of diagnosis. But there's a loss, obviously. There's a loss of the Asperger's identity. And is that the end of the story? I don't think so. There is what I think of a dark side of the Asperger's diagnosis. If we look at the details of what was said by people embracing the Asperger's diagnosis for themselves or their children, we find a dark side to the Aspie identity. Here is an unguarded remark from Hannah Feldstedt, who has Asperger's. She says, "The label of Asperger's at least gives observers the impression of intelligence and ability. But when most people think of autism, they think of someone who should be institutionalized." Here is another similar statement, not by somebody with autism, but by a psychologist, journalist writing in Psychology Today. "The Asperger's label has helped many who don't fit the classic autism model or stereotype to get a diagnosis and accept their autism. We don't need data to tell us that Asperger's is a less unnerving diagnosis than autism for those who haven't come to terms with their own or their children's special needs. The Asperger's autism dichotomy penalizes and stigmatizes classic autism." And she goes on to quote a blogger, Bridgiana Spencer, who is autistic and a mother of two autistic children, who writes, "Because Asperger's becomes stereotyped as the, quote, good, mild, high-functioning autism, that leaves classic autism with the stigma of the bad kind of autism, simply by the existence of a contrast." Not surprisingly, we find that the Asperger's diagnosis, which has been given until a year ago, is correlated with socioeconomic status. Those lower on the socioeconomic status were more likely to be diagnosed with pervasive developmental disorder of various kinds, or with high-functioning autism. The final quote, I think, is a very brave blogger. "The term Aspie has come to be a way for those of us who want to talk about our experiences to separate ourselves from those autistics. It allows us an identity that has been sanitized for our allistic audience." Allistic just means neurotypical audience. "A way of performing eccentricity instead of disability, of showing we are like them, but still employable. This is disgusting." So what's going on here is a phenomenon that Hilda Lindemann calls hostage taking. The Asperger's identity is made positive by putting down another oppressed group, those with classic autism. Hilda Lindemann's example is anti-gay rhetoric in black rapper communities. She sees that the black rapper identity is developed at the expense of gays. A positive identity, as Hilda characterizes it, is a narrative that fosters the humanity and frees the agency of the members of the group. The Asperger's identity celebrates the abilities of Aspies by explicitly or implicitly contrasting them with the disabilities of those with classic autism. The positive Asperger's identities comes at the cost of damaging the identity of another oppressed group. This is probably also to do the people with classic autism a hermeneutical injustice because the collective understanding of that group will be skewed negatively. Interestingly, Lorna Wing, the person who created the Asperger's diagnosis, has now backtracked. And here's a recent quote from her. "Youngsters with Asperger's syndrome are speaking up for themselves. Many see it as a difference, not a disability, but that's a good and a bad thing. For those with classic autism, like my Susie, it certainly is a disability." Interesting in that Lorna Wing, who developed the classification and became interested in the field as a result of her own daughter being diagnosed on the spectrum, saw the concept develop in ways that she couldn't endorse, and is quite happy for it to go away. Okay, so now some discussion, and I'll take it as far as I can, and then open to your suggestions. Let's take a look at the DSM-5 category of autism spectrum disorder, which most Asperger's falls under. As is often stressed, it's an extremely wide spectrum. One of the familiar sayings in the autism community is, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. There is a huge range of social experiences under the autism spectrum. It's often symbolized by a rainbow, the universal symbol of diversity. Social identities come from shared life experiences. While autism spectrum disorder may be a fine diagnostic category for the purposes of diagnosis, treatment, and research, and that remains to be seen, we don't know yet, it's not very promising as a social identity. In part because of the range and profundity of disability on some parts of the spectrum, there is no empowering group narrative, no shared hermeneutic understanding of areas of social experience. At most, there is an agreement that autistic spectrum disorder covers a range of communicative language, social skills, communicative difficulties, and behavioral patterns. It is, of course, possible that a narrative might be developed with parents or significant others speaking for those who cannot speak. Hilda Lindemann has a beautiful paper in which she talks about her younger sister, Carla, who was born with hydrocephalus, and how her identity was constructed and maintained within the family. So more narrative can be constructed than you might think. But we don't have one now. And I asked Hilda Lindemann about it, and she said, narratives are not easy to construct, and especially they're not easy to successfully disseminate, to get people to pick up. And that's what you need in order for there to be a social understanding of the experience. Well, I think there's some truth to the claim that people with Asperger's have suffered a hermeneutical injustice. That claim should be balanced with the observation that the Asperger's identity is not innocent, at least in the hands of many who have used it. The difference between the paradigm cases that Miranda presents and the case of Asperger's is twofold. First, the enlightenment achieved under feminism and the gay rights movement do not, so far as we know, injure other oppressed groups. And secondly, the hermeneutical knowledge attained by feminism and gay rights groups has achieved the status of a fact, at least in academic philosophy circles. The case of Asperger's reminds us first that an identity that damages others can be experienced as enlightening by those who benefit from it, and secondly, it reminds us that some identities have not achieved the status of facts. In fact, very little about the autistic spectrum has achieved the status of a fact. there's still very little understanding of the causes and the core deficits. The DSM-5, which is actually DSM, they insist it's DSM 5.0 because they want this to be understood as provisional, is trying out a classification which is simpler and tighter than the one in a DSM-4. Instead of Asperger's, high-functioning autism, classic autism, PDD, NOS, and a few other categories, it has simply the autistic spectrum described in degrees of severity, and instead of assessments of three areas, language, social skills, and repetitive behavior, it considers language and social skills together as one area, and repetitive behavior as a second area. It's not totally tidy. As I said before, we still need social communication disorder to pick up the individuals who do not fit into the autistic spectrum disorder. But it does aim to yield an unambiguous diagnosis, one for each person on the spectrum. And maybe it will. It's not been in use very long yet. The DSM aims to satisfy several different constituencies, principally the clinical community and the research community. The clinical community wants reliable diagnostic criteria. The research community also wants a nosology that reflects the current state of knowledge about the causes of psychological conditions and illnesses. Both communities want a single shared classification, not different classifications for different purposes. One way of proceeding here, it might be the way that Miranda would proceed, is to say that the construction of a narrative identity, which is Hilda Lindemann's goal, is quite different from the social facts of the matter. And hermeneutic injustice, despite the use of that word hermeneutic may be a bad word. It may trigger with you narrative and empathy and all that soft stuff, when really we should say hermeneutic injustice only applies when you get the social facts wrong, not the positive framing of them or anything like that. I'm not going to take this tack. I don't think that identity narratives are out of science. I think they're a part of science. I don't think there are scientific categorizations that don't come with narratives of one kind or another. So while I'm open to negative narratives as well as positive ones, I don't want to exclude the positive ones on the grounds that they're not science. Another way of proceeding is to say that the social facts are not settled, and therefore we don't know whether or not disappearing Asperger's constitutes an epistemic injustice. No one thinks that DSM-5 has carved nature at its joints. If they have to bring Asperger's syndrome back, then we can conclude that, a hermeneutic injustice was done. But this answer presumes a monistic philosophy of science, a simple kind of realism, and a future in which there'll be a fact of the matter about whether or not Asperger's syndrome exists. Many people, many philosophers of science, John Dupré, Helen Longino, Ken Waters, Ron Geary, to mention a few, and I'm in this group, think that pluralism is not just a way station to a single truth of the matter. They think pluralism is the continued state of science. In some ways, this case reminds me of Helen Longino's central case from her 1990 book, where she explores more than one theory of the influence of hormones on behavior and concludes that we need them all the theories. She doesn't deny her own preference for one kind of theory, the one with the values that support human freedom, which is the interactionist theory. But she doesn't regard such a preference as a reason to reject or discard the linear hormonal theory, the one she doesn't like, the one that she thinks has bad values. They're both scientific theories. She finds both of them to be scientifically useful. But what of the DSM, you might ask? Can the DSM tolerate pluralism in disease classification? One eminent psychiatrist, Robert Michaels, is fond of saying that, quote, the DSM has nothing to do with science. And that always elicits a shock from the audience. I think there's some hyperbole in there, but there's also something valuable in what he's saying. Like many areas of medicine, it serves non-epistemic as well as epistemic goals. So the DSM there is there to help clinically, for example. It's there to help with decisions about responsibility. It may fail, but the goal is to help with these things, to help decisions about reimbursement and supportive services. So the goals of the DSM aren't simply the science. The research science is supposed to have a say, and the clinical medicine is supposed to have, those are the two biggest voices, and there are other voices. I've argued elsewhere that in medicine, you often need unanimity in order to proceed for practical reasons. First of all, there needs to be an authoritative statement about health from the health providers for that to stand any criticism or pushback from the insurance community or other communities. It's difficult to make an authoritative statement if you don't have unanimity. Consensus produces authority. So the DSM, insofar as it has to express one view, is, I think, not just being science, it's being a political document. It's making an authoritative statement. It needs to have just one view. But that shouldn't mean that that's all we do in the science, or that that's the only scientific theory available. If Asperger's syndrome does not exist, no hermeneutical injustice was done. It would be going too far to say that the DSM-5 establishes scientifically that Asperger's syndrome does not exist. It's trying out what it would mean to do without the diagnosis in practical settings. That is taking a risk. It may not work, not because Asperger's syndrome exists, but because the category is practically important to ensuring people get appropriate services. What people have most worried about is that their child will be denied appropriate services. The Asperger's and the autistic spectrum disorder community has the most to lose and also the most to gain here. And I'd like to finish by saying certainly they deserve a voice in future editions of the DSM. Thank you.
Ask you a little bit about the ignorance to knowledge to ignorance idea, because it seems to me if you're thinking of hermeneutical resources and hermeneutical justice, we're not in the same place now, even though it's been taken out of the DSM, yeah, that we were. There may be a time when the whole idea of Asperger's syndrome is long forgotten. Then maybe we'd be back there. But it seems there's still a discourse, there's people upset, those resources are still there for trying to articulate,
yes,
their experience, even if it doesn't have the same status that it did when it was official.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that, you know, the word Asperger's is even going to stay in the DSM under, quote, formally called Asperger's, for a while. And maybe the Asperger's community, the community of people with Asperger's and those connected with them will keep that category alive. But there's no denying that they've been denied a certain status and social recognition. So that could be a hermeneutical injustice.
Thanks so much. So yeah, connected with Heidi's question. So I guess that I always would want to ask whether there's a loss of intelligibility with the concept going away. And if, given what you two have just said, it sounds like there wouldn't be straight away, but there could be in the future. And so just for me, in terms of my understanding of hermeneutical injustice, that's what it turns on. I do slightly wish it's hermeneutical injustice, I could have just called it interpretive injustice. Because the notion of interpretation, I just thought of the two words as equivalent, but there's always a really difficult fading between fact and value. And that's why it's a tricky category, and that's why I sort of almost wanted it to have a funny technical term. Because it is.
Did you want it to just be a... just point to the facts and not to the values?
If you're a realist about the interpretations, you'll call them facts. But some people, and so they might include moral interpretations. And since some people aren't realists about moral interpretations, I didn't want to pin my colours to that mast. I personally have realist inclinations about the moral. But the word understanding is quite usefully ambiguous there too, because you can talk, even anti-realists about the moral might think, well, there are moral understandings and we construct them, but they won't be happy to say that moral facts are constructed. So that's the region I think about. Is there a gain or a loss in understanding the social experience? And so for me, that's what the question turns on. And so given that you asked us to answer the question, for me, the answer to the question is, that's what it turns on. And from what you two just said, it sounds like there wouldn't be a hermeneutical injustice in any immediate kind, but there might be down the road. Loss of sort of identity aspects to me is a separate thing.
So you want to separate identity from understanding?
Yes, in terms of that you can have an unjust deficit of understanding regardless of what's going on with identity, and you could have difficulties around identity where the understanding was all perfectly intact. And so hermeneutical injustice, although it might commonly be associated with other sorts of unfair results like loss of positive identification and so on, that's not part of the injustice itself, on my perception.
So if you, I'm trying to understand, if you take, go back to, for example, the case of postpartum depression, I guess the what would be the identity that went with the hermeneutical understanding? Something like
it could be like it's not me. I'm not being weird about things. This is an understandable condition.
Yes, this is a bond with all other mothers who have the same, who go through the same.
There might not be a kind of club of postpartum depressives. There's a sense in which the sense of fault goes away and so on. All that is a positive result from the achievement of the understanding.
Right. But you separate it from the achievement of the understanding?
Yes, not causally. I mean, one might cause the other. But analytically speaking, the question of whether there's a hermeneutical injustice or not is contained in the degree to which there's the understanding. It's possible. You've got the requisite tools for understanding.
I think I understand.
So at first when you started talking about whether or not there's a hermeneutical injustice here, I was on board with you, and I was really on board with thinking that it looks to be somewhat importantly different from the more classic cases that we've seen. And then you gave the reasons for thinking that is so, and I found myself starting to question it. And the main reason you pointed out was that you said, whereas the Aspie identity seems to be throwing another group under the bus in a sense, right? It's damaging to somebody else. And you said, but that isn't the case with the enlightenment gained from women and people in the LGBT group, right? Except, right, there's tons of examples where people have charged them, right?
With throwing the disability under the bus.
And gaining rights. And I think to some extent, I'm trying to think of an example, but I think you can argue of some sort of enlightenment, too. Like, maybe like when women started claiming, like, there's women's voices, and that has something to do with our biology, right? And then that's like going to be further damaging to other people.
Great point. I guess what I would say is, to the extent that they did throw the other people under the bus, it was a mixed bag. And I think the fact that these identities have survived to some degree is partly due to the having shed them. But they haven't completely, so maybe you're right, and I'm they're muddier cases than I thought. I was trying more to suggest to Miranda that this was different from her cases, because her cases, everyone agreed that those movements were great things. But it's fine if they're not great things. it was more of a rhetorical point. If they're all as muddy as Asperger's, then that's, you know, that's our current place in hermeneutical understanding.
I think I wanted to press you on a similar point. Because it sounds like what's happening to Asperger's syndrome is not that we're forgetting it exists. It sounds like if the authors of the DSM-5 are right, then we're coming to understand that what we thought of as sort of a clear and distinct category with a bunch of traits bundled together is in fact more sort of, it's a spectrum from Asperger's to autism, or maybe more properly, a set of spectra that overlap, right? Well, it seems like we have analogous cases with race, gender, mm-hmm. sex, and sexuality. And granted, in all these things, people worry that when we start talking about, you know, getting rid of the old sort of rigid categories in favor of an understanding of overlapping spectra, that we'll worry that we'll lose out on identities that have been important for liberation and purposes. But at the same time, well, especially in sort of the philosophical community, don't we usually think we're making hermeneutical games when we understand that these categories are more porous and diverse than we thought? So isn't this a game for autism and spectrum and Asperger's, at least theoretically, however badly that works out in political practice?
Hmm. Well, I love the question. You know, my most immediate reaction to that is that it conjures up the phrase, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, is that it makes the identity categories that people have found so meaningful about their lives go away. So I think insofar as we see the world and categories of identities, and we don't see each person as a unique individual, they continue to be useful.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, I was reminded that this question about whether Pluto is a planet, it seems to be of the set of kind of the same category of questions. Now we say, well, what is a planet, right? And how, what different kinds of criteria are there to, you know, by which we would want to classify? I mean, we just heard on the news the other day that there's a new chunk of rock out there that is actually in orbit around the sun. So I just thought it would be might be useful to throw that out as a non-medical instance of a case where there is, I guess you could say, there's a hermeneutical. I mean, some people would regard it as an injustice, right? To say, well, Pluto was always a planet, and, you know, we worship the planet Pluto, and if you're going to say it's not a planet anymore, that's an injustice to our group.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, this gentleman behind me here just said, I think it's enlightening to be able to understand the different ways in which you can classify things as planet mm-hmm. or not planet, and probably the same thing is true of some medical diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The important thing, it seems to me, would be to try to understand, well, what are the criteria?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a sensible way to look at that and to say, well, is it the composition? Is it the mass? Is it the mass ratio to, you know, the diameter to mass, or other aspects of its orbit, or what else is in orbit with it? Thing. So the same kind of question probably could be raised with regard to Asperger's, and it may be there is some, you know, way in which it can be defined that really does delimit it
mm-hmm.
At one end of the spectrum, but still would create a way of having its own identity.
Yeah. I think there are some similarities between the planetary case and this case. and I'm trying to remember how the Pluto case came about. So I think Pluto would still be a planet if they hadn't found a whole bunch of other small exoplanets around there and decided they needed a principled criterion for what gets called a planet and what gets called an exoplanet. They were also forced, in the case of Asperger's syndrome, to try to get clear criteria so that they can say, they can classify diseases in standard forms. And you might say, why do that? Well, it's because education, clinical judgments, and research. If everybody has slightly different classification, it's going to be difficult to gather data, standardize treatment, and so on. So they'd have that in common. They have in common that they were, well, let's try out a different classification and see whether that's going to work. And maybe they share some arbitrary features. I mean, I when I heard the Plato thing, the Pluto thing, my reaction was, why not have 1,000 planets? Well, apparently, people want the number of planets you can count on two hands. So that's a funny constraint, but it played in it some way. People with Asperger's are to some degree concerned that they won't get the treatments that are appropriate for their condition, because if it's just in one autistic spectrum, they worry that what's going to happen is there'll be treatments prescribed for that whole spectrum without the proper nuance to their specific issues.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, people that I know of who have been told I have Asperger's, and in some cases I haven't met them, but they, like, you know, have PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
They're fully functioning, but they may be kind of antisocial in some respects,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, so I don't know a lot about it, but I mean, that would be definitely, it would be definitely, it's a question of, I guess, how people are received, and there is, there's an identity issue there,
mm-hmm.
that people would have this diagnosis, understand it as being a kind of just a difference, not necessarily that they need to be treated,
mm-hmm.
but that's simply the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
Another question. Hi. So I just had a little thought. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is useful. So I just love the idea that, you know, there can be concept gained and then concept lost. I just think that's a really, really interesting possibility. And I just suddenly remembered an analogy in moral philosophy in meta ethics. So Bernard Williams notoriously argued in Ethics and Limits of Philosophy that he's got a non-objectivist conception of moral knowledge, so he thinks that we, roughly speaking, construct moral knowledge from fairly stable resources, some of which are grounded in human nature, some of which are much more historically contingent. And he observes that, maybe it's not an observation, he argues that reflection, among other things, critical reflection, can put some concepts out of service. So they go out of... The way I think about it sometimes by analogy with currency. So over time, but owing to critical reflection, you put certain concepts out of service as real currency. So you can't buy stuff with them anymore. You can't gain moral knowledge by applying the concept of female chastity anymore.
Right.
But they're still around. We haven't lost the concepts, but we can't use them in that way. So I can't know as a piece of my moral knowledge that so-and-so is or isn't chaste. But I can apply the concept historically and use it to, you know, question whether Queen Elizabeth I was chaste or not and understand the debates at the time around that, rather in the way I can add up shillings and
mm-hmm.
sovereigns. I can't actually, but anyway, I might be able to work it. So there's a phenomenon which could be connected here of concepts going out of use for a particular sort of discourse. So in the Williams cases, they go out of use for extant moral discourse because we don't relate to them in the right way, manner of psychological endorsement. It's not my moral life that can be illuminated by using the concept of charity, but chastity, but I still can use that concept historically. Well, in that sense, is that phenomenon that means that reflection can destroy ethical knowledge in his notorious phrase. And I just wondered whether this idea that there isn't sort of a total net loss of knowledge or understanding, but there's a particular type of knowledge in my world, like my moral knowledge, or maybe in the autism Asperger case, knowledge of who I am that's connected with identity narratives that you're interested in, that really does get lost. So although there might not straight away be an immediate loss of intelligibility, there's a way of knowing that you've got Asperger's that really has become unavailable.
Or that will become.
Yeah, well, or maybe it's even pretty instant, is what I was wondering, because, or insofar as the concept really has gone out of use, I suppose that's going to change. So I just wondered if there's an analogy there that although the sort of nature of the experience of being a person with Asperger's are still intelligible because the concepts are there, they're not there in quite the right key anymore to produce self-knowledge in the way that you used to, just like the concept of chastity stood around, but I don't relate to it in the right way anymore, to use it to have knowledge of my moral world.
Yeah, well, we're a good example. I'm older than you. I can do pounds, shillings, and pence. I can do long division with pounds, shillings, pence, and halfpennies, actually.
Okay.
Farthings precede me.
But you know, sometimes whether we can have a certain type of knowledge using a concept might depend on our psychological relation to that concept, rather as in the moral case, depends whether we endorse it as one of our concepts that makes our moral world. So I just wonder, this is just a kind of not much more than opening a possible line of thought, but it might be that one way to develop your idea would be not only to ask whether it's unmutable injustice or not, but to ask whether once the concept's gone out of use, whether it can be used to gain knowledge in the right way anymore to help
Casual
self-knowledge. Just a thought.
And I would expect the answer would be no.
Yeah,
you know, and that's why it's a hermeneutical. Well, you wouldn't say that's why it's a hermeneutical.
I don't know.
Maybe
the category is flexible, but anyway, I too would expect the answer would be no. And so I think there's a really interesting phenomenon there in the whether one wants to expand the category of hermeneutical injustice to incorporate it or think, we've got a really interesting new phenomenon here. I think that would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Any final questions?
All right, let's thank you.